Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Tragedy of Heterosexuality by Jane Ward, narrated by Dow Rosenberg. 1. Let's call it what it is. The Tragedy of Heterosexuality. I am worried about straight people, and I am not the only one. Queer people have been concerned about straight culture for decades, not only for our own sake, because we fear homophobic violence or erasure of queer subculture, but also because straight culture's impact on straight women often elicits our confusion and distress, erotically uninspired or coercive, given shape by the most predictable and punishing gender roles, emotionally scripted by decades of inane media and self-help projects, and outright illogical as a set of intimate relations anchored in a complaint-ridden swirl of desire and misogyny. Straight culture for many queers is perplexing at best and repulsive at worst. And yet queer people often leave the issue alone because no matter how worrisome straight culture may appear to us, we know all too well the problems with denying people their erotic attachments or critiquing an entire population's sexual orientation. Am I being hyperbolic when I say I'm worried about straight people? Granted, this is an unfamiliar way of thinking about heterosexuality for most straight and many gay people. Living under the weight of heteronormativity means that a lot of people have come to understand heterosexuality as the most instinctive and fulfilling form of sexual relating. We are subject, as children and adults, to an onslaught of institutions and media images that link basic human happiness and nearly all significant rites of passage to heterosexual desire and coupling. And, as many queer people will attest, it can be very difficult, depressing, shameful, lonely, frightening, vulnerable, violent, and traumatic to be lesbian, gay, or bisexual. Many queers have wished to be straight, and many have come to the conclusion that the undeniable easiness of heterosexuality relative to queerness is evidence of the idea that no one chooses to be queer. What rational person would choose a life of anti-gay oppression? Through the lens of queer suffering, it seems almost ludicrous to feel concern for straight people, at least not on account of their straightness. For straight people experiencing other violent and dehumanizing forms of oppression, poverty, white supremacy, patriarchy, ableism, religious discrimination. Straightness offers a degree of respectability and privilege. As the African-American feminist and activist Barbara Smith explained in 1979, heterosexual privilege is usually the only privilege that black women have. Maintaining straightness is our last resort. Straightness is a means through which people can access some unearned cultural and institutional rewards vis-a-vis the marginalization of their queer counterparts. Straightness ameliorates other forms of suffering and creates an easier life. So if being straight makes life easier, why on earth would queer people spend any time feeling worry or sympathy about the effects of straight culture on straight people's lives and relationships? This book argues that the basic premise of this question, that heterosexuality is easier than queerness, requires renewed investigation. For instance, if we were to take this premise to the contemporary lesbian feminist Sarah Achmed, we would be encouraged to consider that one of the ways heteronormativity sustains itself is by telling and retelling a story about how heterosexuality makes people happy, while queerness produces difficulty and suffering. This story about queer suffering under the force of heteronormativity is true. But it is also only a sliver of the story about queerness. And it is one that masks not only queer joy and pleasure, but also queer relief not to be straight. The story about the benefits of heterosexuality is also one with wildly differing levels of truthfulness or explanatory power. Once subjected to an intersectional analysis, the late lesbian feminist poet and theorist Adrienne Rich contended that while being straight was largely beneficial for men, the same was not always true for women, for whom the institution of heterosexuality had been a site of violence, control, diminishment, and disappointment. Similarly, straight black feminists, from Michelle Wallace to Brittany Cooper, have long raised questions about the gap between the promises of heteronormativity and the realities of Black women's relationships with men. Straight Black men benefit considerably from straight relationships, while, as Cooper explains, the privileges of straightness have eluded me and a whole generation of overachieving Black women. Perhaps most urgently, an important indicator of the relatively negligible value of heterosexuality for many women is the fact that their sexual relationships with men have been maintained by force, both through cultural propaganda targeting girls and women, and more directly through sexual assault, incest, compulsory marriage, economic dependence, control of children, and domestic violence. This book will provide ample evidence of these dynamics. The question then is heterosexuality optimal for women when it requires so much coercion? Gay men, especially white gay men, are often the greatest defenders of the narrative about queer suffering, probably because they have more power and privilege to lose as a result of inhabiting a non-normative sexual orientation, and sometimes a non-normative gender. Relatedly, gay men are also more likely than lesbians to embrace biological theories of sexual orientation and the corresponding claim that people are only gay because they have no choice in the matter. These perspectives have drowned out lesbian feminist discussions about erotic agency and the appeal of queer joy, and they have prevented us from investigating the various ways that a woman might respond when, to use Cooper's phrase, the privileges of straightness elude her. It is my belief that gay men's persistent ownership of the meaning and origins of queerness, along with many gay men's lack of concern about the lives of women, has made it difficult to shift our attention away from what is sad about being gay to what is even sadder about being straight. My aim is to show that when we hold the relationship between misogyny and heterosexuality in full view, we are able to see beyond the male-centric claim that queerness constitutes a tragic and unwilled loss of power, a loss that no one would ever choose, even as it brings sexual pleasure and fosters the pride of the oppressed. Still today, misogyny is rarely ever meaningfully scrutinized in mainstream gay rights discourse, so the reasonable suggestion that women stand to gain more than they lose by extracting themselves from heterosexual culture and cultivating queerness has become nearly impossible to hear amid the Born This Way chorus. For all of these reasons, I am of the mind that lesbian feminist critiques of heterosexuality, now sometimes dismissed as outdated, have renewed relevance and urgency. This book is about a critical but still largely overlooked consequence of the drowning out of lesbian feminist ideas and experiences. When lesbian feminist ideas are sidelined, we keep our focus on queer misery, and we fail to name the contradictions and miseries of straight culture, the entrapment, the disappointment, the antagonism, the boredom, the unwanted sex, the toxic masculinity, and the countless daily injustices endured by straight women. This book is about the failure to recognize these not only as feminist problems, but more specifically as straight problems that many queer women are wildly grateful to have escaped. While conservatives have long promoted the belief that queer relationships are unnatural, damaged, and fraught with various kinds of dysfunction, this project examines what might be gained from raising similar questions about the health and sustainability of heterosexual culture, a culture arguably damaged by misogyny, even as it has been unwilling to address the structural causes of this damage. I will show that the narrative about the tragedy of queerness, the seemingly gender-neutral claim that no one would ever wish queerness upon themselves, does not reflect many queer women's lived experiences. And yet, there is no denying that countless lesbians have adopted this narrative. Is it possible that this story about the tragedy of queerness is more a rhetorical habit, an idea we've internalized from gay men, not to mention worried family members, bad television, or the church? Some years ago, I was chatting about parenting with a lesbian couple with a child close in age to my own. We arrived at the topic of children's sexuality. and one of the lesbian moms made a comment I have heard before, a comment that lesbian and gay people are perhaps more likely to share openly than lefty straight parents. If I am to be totally honest, I would prefer, for our child's sake, that he isn't gay. We don't want him to have to deal with the challenges that comes with being gay. Despite the stark reality of homophobic bullying, this logic didn't ring true to me, and I was struck by how normalized it had become to say something about queerness. No one would choose to be gay, or I don't want my child to be gay like me. That most people I know would be quite unlikely to say about almost any other form of difference subject to violence and oppression. I then asked these lesbian moms, "Do you really feel that way? Do you feel like your own life has been so terrible that you wish your parents could have saved you from it? Do you feel that being straight would have been better for you?" These women both smiled, looked at each other, laughed, and said, "No, I see your point." I didn't probe further, but what I imagined those sly smiles were reflecting was their instantaneous flashback to all that was pleasurable and joyous about their lesbian lives. I have no idea what they were actually thinking, but the point here is that I suspect many queers love the queer part of their lives, even when they have been trained to rehearse a narrative about how hard and tragic it all is. This narrative bolsters heteronormativity not only by obscuring the profound forms of queer joy that accompany and often compensate for queer suffering, but also by implying that heterosexual lives are free of gendered violence and suffering. Let me be clear. Homophobic violence happens to young people and adults, to women, men, and trans people. It happens to straight people when they are gender variant and/or are presumed to be queer. And it happens most harshly to queer people of color and poor and working class queers. In all cases, it is tragic. The ideas behind the popular 2010 It Gets Better campaign, namely, that queer kids can expect to grow up, become autonomous, make money, and discover their entitlement and civil rights, were critiqued for good reason, for eliding the persistent race, class, and gender disparities that shape the lives of many queer people. But misogynistic and racist violence happens to straight people too. And in many ways, gendered and sexualized and racist forms of violence and suffering are much more unrelenting for straight women than for anyone else. When I teach Introduction to Gender and Sexuality Studies at UC Riverside, I show a series of documentary films about gendered violence and suffering. These are films about the horrific violence, sexual, physical, emotional, that women endure at the hands of men and the state, about the incredible toll that masculinity takes on men's bodies and mental health, as well as women's bodies and mental health, and about the tedium and unequal division of labor that destroys or threatens to destroy an astounding number of heterosexual relationships. Even though I have seen these films a dozen times, I still cry when I watch them. And I have always assumed that I am crying feminist tears. I have assumed I am crying for women. But more recently, something shifted. After watching the films, rereading the numerous articles about gender oppression I had assigned, and listening to countless stories from straight women students about their abusive, or just plain not feminist, male partners, I got in my car and breathed a huge sigh of relief that I am queer. I went home and told my partner, "Thank God, we are queer." And I realized that I was crying queer tears for straight people. It became clear to me. Straight women's lives are very, very hard. It's not that it gets better for queer people. It's that heterosexuality is often worse. Often, anger is the dominant mode of relating to heterosexuality among radical queers. But this book argues that it is more appropriate to worry about heterosexuals, to feel empathy, to call them in rather than call them out, and ideally, to be in solidarity with them as they work to liberate heterosexuality from misogyny. Here I take inspiration, in part, from the queer worry expressed by the dazzling figure of Aunt Ida, played by Edith Massey, in John Waters' 1974 cult film, Female Trouble. In an unforgettable scene in which Aunt Ida counsels her straight-identified nephew Gator that she'd be so happy if he turned Nellie, she begs of him, "But you could change. Queers are just better. I'd be so proud of you as a fag. I'd never have to worry. But now I worry that you'll work in an office, have children, celebrate wedding anniversaries. The world of heterosexuals is a sick and boring life." Like Aunt Ida, I reverse the direction of the ally relationship, such that queers become concerned allies to the straights in our families and communities, especially the women who may be experiencing more gendered suffering than we are. And without the hot sex, queer humor, and political solidarity to which many of us queers have access. There is no doubt that my own queerness, feminist, whiteness, able-bodiedness, and position as a scholar living in the United States have shaped and limited my ways of thinking about straightness. To understand the intersexual complexities of lesbian feminist critiques of straightness, I have leaned heavily on the writings of queer feminists of color and placed their insights at the forefront of my analysis. I could not be more grateful to have access to their path-breaking work, much of which offers an extraordinary model of how to balance critique and love, pain and solidarity. To the straight people listening to this book, let me say with all my love and solidarity, I am your ally. The Tragedy of Heterosexuality, A Lesbian Feminist Diagnosis. Let me quickly assure you that this book is not so much about straight people themselves, but about the straight culture in which they are embedded and to which they are held accountable. As with the often nebulous racial category of whiteness, one of the ways that we avoid looking critically at straightness is to keep it indefinable, to imagine that it is so vast and irreducible to any one way of being. A queer person makes a critical statement about straightness to which a straight person will object. "How can you say that? There are so many different kinds of straight people. Many straight men, like my husband/boyfriend/brother, are gentle and feminist. Many straight relationships are egalitarian, loving, and based on feminist principles." We might even characterize these claims as #notallstraightpeople. And of course, these claims are true. They also function, however, to invalidate queer critiques of straight culture, to silence or otherwise shut down queer witness testimony about the straight world. As when white people protest that critiques of racism should not tar all whites with one brush, the intention behind this kind of request to avoid overgeneralizations is typically to focus on exceptions. Many people like to identify with the exceptions, which soften the sting of critique and accountability. So let us acknowledge those exceptions. Feminist straight men and feminist men's projects do exist, though I can count the ones I know personally on one hand, maybe two. Men do more housework and parenting labor than they used to, though not much more, recent evidence suggests. Some straight people live queerish lives, engaging in polyamory, heteroflexibility, kink, marriage refusal, and so forth, though it is unclear the extent to which these practices challenge the real problems at the heart of straight culture. There are straight couples that are very happy. There are men who love and respect women deeply. There are men who are raised by feminists, lesbians, and lesbian feminists. There are men who are attracted to aging women, hairy women, fat women, powerful women, and feminist women. But none of these feminist modes of relating have made much of a dent in straight culture, the subject of my analysis. So what is straight culture as seen through a queer feminist lens? As this book will explore in depth, queer/lesbian complaints about straight culture have circulated around two overarching themes, with several additional sub-themes considered in the chapters to follow. First, queer feminists have argued that straight life is characterized by the inescapable influence of sexism and toxic masculinity, both of which are either praised or passively tolerated in straight spaces. Second, Queer observers of straight life have pointed to straight women's endless and ineffective efforts to repair straight men and the pain of witnessing straight women's optimism and disappointment. While some queers might now balk at the idea of spending our precious time theorizing heterosexuality or standing in solidarity with straight women, these were central projects for lesbian feminists in the 1970s and 80s. Lesbian feminists thoroughly documented and theorized the tragedy of heterosexuality beginning in the early 1970s, though they used different terms and came to different conclusions than my own. Their archive is vast, and I offer only a very quick summary here. As for the normalized sexism inside straight culture, lesbian feminists wrote volumes. With righteous rage, they detailed the ways that straight men desired women's services, emotional, sexual, reproductive, domestic, rather than actual women. And they exposed the toll this took on women's mental health. The radical lesbians declared, by virtue of being brought up in a male society, we have internalized the male culture's definition of ourselves, as relative beings who exist not for ourselves, but for the servicing, maintenance, and comfort of men. They described recoiling from men's misogyny. I began to avoid him, to sleep with him to shut him up, to be silent out of exhaustion, to take tranquilizers. Audre Lorde described sex with men as dismal and frightening and a little demeaning. Gloria Anzaldúa recounted the misogyny inside straight Mexican culture, wherein woman is the stranger, the other, man's recognized nightmarish pieces, his shadow beast. The sight of her sends him into a frenzy of fear, and consequently, Anzaldúa explains, I made the choice to be queer. Kate Millett put forward a theory of patriarchy as a heterosexual political system maintained through men's sexual power over women, in families as well as in the public sphere, that had naturalized rape and other forms of men's sexual coercion and control of women. Cherry Moraga concurred that the control of women begins through the institution of heterosexuality, adding that a man wants to be able to determine how, when, and with whom his women, mother, wife, and daughter, are sexual. For without male-imposed social and legal control of our reproductive function, Chicanas might freely choose otherwise, including being sexually independent from and or with men. Lesbian feminists noted that even men on the left, the seemingly good men who promised to respect women, ultimately caused women tremendous suffering. Andrea Dworkin, who is now often vilified for her fervent opposition to porn, BDSM, and sex work, came to lesbian feminism after experiencing severe physical and sexual abuse at the hands of her anarchist activist husband. He hit, kicked, burned, and raped her, and subsequently engaging in sex work for survival. Dworkin experienced multiple other instances of misogynistic violence in her life, and as she delved more deeply into feminist work, the astounding ubiquity and normalization of misogyny and men's violence against women became clear to her. I heard about rape after rape. Women who had been raped in homes, in cars, on beaches, in alleys, in classrooms, by one man, by two men, by five men, by eight men, hit, drugged, knifed, torn. Women who had been sleeping, women who were with their children. In the mid-1970s, at the height of lesbian feminist writing, marital rape was legal in every state in the United States, and hence, rape was understood by lesbian feminists not only as an act of patriarchy, but also as a normalized expression of heterosexuality. Though not a lesbian, but arguably queer, the African-American feminist scholar Bell Hooks, too, described the frequency with which straight women fled abusive relationships with ostensibly enlightened men. Individual heterosexual women came to the movement from relationships where men were cruel, unkind, violent, unfaithful. Many of these men were radical thinkers who participated in movements for social justice, speaking out on behalf of the workers, the poor, speaking out on behalf of racial justice. However, when it came to the issue of gender, they were as sexist as their conservative cohorts. As lesbian feminists witnessed radical straight men remain in denial about patriarchy, many gave up on the feminist possibilities for straight men and for straight relationships. During the 1970s and 80s, lesbian feminists also established that while sexism was a foundational element of straight culture, how sexism manifested itself in women's lives was significantly variable. What would later be termed intersectional. Race, culture, socioeconomic class, and religion produced specific forms of heteropatriarchy, and hence, straight culture itself was never monolithic. In 1977, the black feminist members of the Combahee River Collective statement, many of whom were queer, theorized that the forces of white supremacy and heteropatriarchy often overlapped, serving two functions at once. Black girls are told in the same breath to be quiet both for the sake of being ladylike and to make us less objectionable in the eyes of white people. Like white lesbian feminists, black and Chicana lesbians detailed men's violence against women partners and family members, but they also extended this analysis to radical movements, the Black Nationalist Movement, the Chicano Power Movement, contexts in which women of color were expected to provide service to men and to follow men's leadership. Though not a lesbian feminist text, Michelle Wallace's 1978 feminist classic, Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman, painted a powerful image of the self-sacrifice expected of straight black women vis-a-vis the racist oppression of black men. Every time she starts to wonder about her own misery, to think about reconstructing her own life, to shake off her devotion and feeling of responsibility to everyone but herself, the ghosts pounce. The ghosts talk to her. You crippled the black man. You worked against him. You betrayed him. You laughed at him. You scorned him. You and the white man. Wallace, echoing the Combahee River Collective, knew that anti-racist political solidarity with men was vital to the survival of women of color, but that true liberation must also center an analysis of patriarchy. In similarly intersectional work, Chicana lesbian feminists, including Cherry Moraga, Gloria Anzaldúa, and Carla Trujillo, showed that one-dimensional concerns about the effects of racism on men of color, and not women, were exacerbated by religious and cultural beliefs about women as natural caretakers. Both sets of beliefs intersected to amplify women's sense of emotional, sexual, and political duty to men. Similarly, lesbian feminist analyses of socioeconomic class, such as found in the essays of the white working-class lesbian writer Dorothy Allison, illuminated the ways that white working-class cultural values, self-sacrifice, silence, survival, and tradition reinforced men's control over women inside straight relationships. Lesbian feminists were also alarmed by the amount of time and energy straight women were investing in trying to gain men's respect, with either painfully slow or non-existent results. In 1972, the Women's Caucus of the Gay Revolution Party issued a statement in which they expressed serious concern that straight women seem to believe that through their attempts to create new men, they will liberate themselves. Enormous amounts of female energy are expended in this process, with little effect. Sexism remains the overwhelming problem in the most liberated, loving heterosexual situations. The white lesbian separatist, Jill Johnston, pronounced that she was identifying as a woman-committed woman rather than a feminist, explaining, "So many feminists advocated change in our situation in relation to the man rather than devotion of our energies to our own kind." Lesbian feminist writers also documented the ways that girls and women were groomed by straight culture to desire relationships with men, despite the overwhelming evidence that heterosexual relationships were unequal. The promise of love and happiness, according to Adrienne Rich, was the lure that seduced girls and women into a thinly veiled relationship of subjection. As Rich explains, the ideology of heterosexual romance beamed at her childhood out of fairy tales, television, films, advertising, popular songs, wedding pageantry, is a tool ready to the procurer's hand and one which he does not hesitate to use. Lesbian feminist writing made exceedingly clear the contradictions and precariousness of heterosexuality as a system equally organized around love and abuse, manifest in the story told to countless little girls. He hits you because he likes you. Indeed, as feminist historians have argued, This exchange of potential love and protection for servitude is, historically speaking, heterosexual romance's defining moment. A mountain of evidence. But let us get more specific and more current. Part of why it is important to return to classic lesbian feminist text.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?